Today we are here for our podcast on caring for patients with substance use disorders. This is part of our initial material for the Reproductive Real Talk Reproductive Health Workshop that will be going on in June and then again in February, I believe. Today here we have Dr. David Ryan, who is an expert in the field. We're really grateful for your expertise to have benefited your arrival here to Eastern North Carolina, taking care of our patients here. And why don't you just tell everyone a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Knight. It's a pleasure to be here today. So yes, I am a OBGYN and an addiction medicine physician. I completed my residency in OBGYN at the University of North Carolina in 2011. And then I was in private practice here in Greenville, North Carolina for almost 9 years. When I guess I could say I just felt a calling or a pull to work with patients with substance use disorders. And I sort of kind of started by doing, you know, a half day a week of Suboxone prescribing in an outpatient clinic. And I realized two things very quickly. Number one, that I love the work. And number two, that I reached the end of my knowledge and my abilities very quickly. And I knew if I wanted to do it well, and if I wanted to do it professionally, I needed to get additional training. So that actually led me to leave private practice and go back and do a fellowship in 2020, which was an interesting year for several reasons. And I went back to the University of North Carolina and completed an addiction medicine fellowship. So that is how I have board certifications in both of those fields. I spent a year at Virginia Commonwealth University working for the Division of Addictions under their Department of Psychiatry. I came back and was a medical director at Walter B. Jones for a year, and I joined with ECU September of last year, and it's been a wonderful transition, and I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much, and we are very happy to have you here. So why do you think pregnancy and the postpartum period require such specialized care when dealing with substance use disorders?
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful point that you bring that up. It is a very, it's an interesting time. It's a challenging time, but it's also what I like to call a very opportune time. So oftentimes when women are entering the healthcare system, it is oftentimes, you know, for the first time, usually it can be as a result of a pregnancy. Whether planned or unplanned, some of it has to do with access to insurance or care, and a lot of it just has to do with the fact that they're pregnant and they want to seek out the prenatal care. So it's an opportunity to be able to meet people, you know, at a very vulnerable time in their lives and a time when you can really truly make an impact. It is an extraordinarily, I don't have to necessarily explain this, but pregnancy is an extraordinarily stressful time and has a lot of demands, and then the postpartum time is even that much more stressful and that much more demanding. And all of those things are just compounded when patients have a substance use disorder, either in recovery or active use.
There are definitely a lot of unique considerations when caring for the patient population. You also have the patient, the birthing person, and also the developing neonate who was receiving the care as well. So I know that oftentimes in my experience as a general OBGYN, I've seen a lot of people kind of hesitant to take care of the unique pain considerations when dealing with labor pain, when dealing with women who are having difficulties getting medication, also with getting that access to care. So it's really great to be able to spread the word and let people know about what is out there. So what has been done in the past several years to improve access to women's care when it's related to substance use?
Yeah, I think that there have been several improvements in what we've been able to offer, but gosh knows there is still so much work that has to be done. It's an actually very, I don't want to say exciting time, because there's obviously a lot of challenges and a lot of heartbreak in this field, but it's a time when everything seems to now be aligning, meaning that access is now starting to increase. The evidence to support certain treatments is now very robust. A lot of clinicians have we have a wide depth of knowledge, I guess, in the field about things that work, the things that don't, just because we've been doing these things for a while and now we know kind of best practices. And also, I think the general population is now aware not only of the dire need for treatment, but starting to understand the idea of addiction being a chronic medical disease as opposed to a moral failing. I think there's much more acceptance of the medical aspect of the care at this point. So all of those things combined I think is finally kind of moving things in the right direction. We, speaking in a large, you know, as a society sense, oftentimes programs that accept patients or that are doing, you know, medication for opioid use disorder or residential programs or methadone clinics, oftentimes they're either instructed by the federal government, their state agencies, or just their own policies to make sure that pregnant women are moved to the top of the list, because there still is very limited access for a lot of patients. And theoretically, patients who are pregnant are supposed to be moved to the top in order to get the care that they need. And there's a lot more education and willingness for the generalists, the OBGYNs, to start either asking the questions about substance use or trying to get people referred, because it's a hard thing to ask. It's a hard thing to recommend that a generalist ask a question if they don't know what they're going to do with the answer, right? You never want to tell somebody to do something and then, okay, then they get a yes to a screening test. Well, now what? There are a lot more programs that are available, and I think that those resources are now being built, like clinics that can offer both obstetrical and addiction care, kind of this co-location of services, which is a model that has proved very, very effective in a lot of other health systems. Gosh, Medicaid expansion is one of the single best things that can happen to the substance use disorder population, giving them access to the healthcare system and to medications that are life-saving and life-extending. All of these things have been really exciting improvements over the last, even, gosh, 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that this continues to be the trend and we keep moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
So as of right now, where can pregnant and postpartum women and where can providers send these patients to get the appropriate care to help get them the medication, treatment, rehabilitation, and basically the resources they need?
Yep. So the first thing is that across a state level, Dr. B. Jones, here in Greenville, North Carolina, is a state-run alcohol and drug treatment center, and they are the quote-unquote perinatal hub, that they're the ones that patients who are pregnant are typically referred to, and which is a wonderful role that they have. We have several residential programs here in Eastern North Carolina that are run by Roberson Healthcare. The Village is the one that we have in Greenville, which is a long-term residential care facility. There is a wonderful program out in the western part of the state with MAHEC, the Mountain AHEC organization, and Project CARA, which is doing a lot of work in the perinatal space. And there's also through the DHHS, or the Department of Health and Human Services, a hotline that one can call in order to find out what the availability of beds, treatment programs, residential programs for pregnant women who need kind of that higher level of care. For outpatient medicine or prescribing or follow-up, we certainly have, again, there are lots of programs that are offering both obstetrical and perinatal services. We're hoping to start something here at ECU probably in the fall of 2024, which will be a wonderful thing to be able to offer. And right now, too, ECU is expanding their addiction medicine services, and we have an outpatient clinic that is catering to specifically for substance use disorder patients.
Yeah, and it definitely has been a great resource to have. It's been wonderful having you around in the outpatient setting and also to assist with our patients inpatient as well. Do you feel that the providers in the area have been utilizing the resources here?
Yes, I think they have. They're new. We are growing as an addiction medicine service, which is, again, an exciting thing to be a part of. And we have some inpatient presence. We have some outpatient presence. But we are absolutely expanding. And I think we are becoming more well-known in the hospital. And it is always wonderful when my obstetrical colleagues reach out and I'm able to offer inpatient guidance. But our health system as a whole is now starting to know that we exist. That's the biggest obstacle, I think, that we've encountered this far, is letting people know that we're here.
Yeah.
And right now I'm starting to see an uptick in consults specifically asking for addiction care, which is a brand new thing. So I think that we're getting more well known.
Yeah.
And we're getting better utilized, which is exciting.
And I'm hoping that this podcast actually also helps to spread the word further and reach out to various providers in not only obstetrics and gynecology, but also to other providers that care for our same patients, because there are going to be a lot of people hopefully listening to this that will encounter, you know, women that need this care, mm-hmm. throughout different phases of their recovery, throughout different phases of their healthcare. And with those expansions, hopefully they're getting those experiences and exposures to providers who can get them to you and all those other places that, that can help them.
I certainly hope so. I can tell you there's a couple different ways to get our services involved. In the outpatient setting, if you're in the ECU system, it's simply an ambulatory referral to psychiatry order, and you would just put addictions in the comment, and that gets that put. We have our own scheduler, and we have our own scheduling block, and that kind of shunts that referral to that. So if you're trying to get somebody seen as an outpatient, that's the best way to do it. Ambulatory referral to psychiatry, put addictions in the comment, specifically the substance, if you know what that is, and we can get patients scheduled. The inpatient setting, if you are looking to get our team involved, you put in an order, a consult order for psychiatry, and you just write addictions in the comment, and that puts them on our radar. And we've started to see an uptick in that and both of those being utilized, which is really exciting.
And how can someone who is outside of our health system get in contact with your division to get referred over?
If they're an Epic, I believe it's the same way that you can do that. If it is also an Epic, you can simply send me an in-basket message. I'm more than happy to answer in-basket messages, core texts, or even emails. We could even provide my email address. I'm happy to facilitate that as well. I'm actually partially grant funded by an organization called NC Star, whose specific goal it is to seek out and expand the network of providers who are prescribing Suboxone. So if you are also a provider who's listening, who is thinking about offering Suboxone, but it sounds overwhelming and you don't even know really where to start and you don't know what kind of resources are available, that's also a great reason to reach out to me, because I am connected to an organization that can literally provide anything and everything that one would need, education, support, a number to call, anything that anybody would want in order to start doing Suboxone. So just keep that in mind. But if you're outside of our health system, best way to do that is sending me an in-basket or an email, and then we'll get you connected.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Just to kind of wrap things up, how do you think providers of different specialties or kind of across the board can work to help support patients in their recovery long term?
That's a great question. So I think some of the things that I think were very valuable to me when I went through my addiction medicine fellowship was learning how to speak to patients in a way that is patient-centered and not stigmatizing. And I say this because I think the vast majority of providers are not trying to be stigmatizing, or they're not attempting to use language that can potentially be stigmatizing. But I myself was using stigmatizing language all of the time. And that's the thing I learned about stigma, is it doesn't have to be intentional to be impactful. And learning kind of the words or the language to avoid, and the words that kind of resonate with individuals regarding substance use, can be, first of all, very useful. And then it's also just about maintaining just a genuine curiosity, which I think a lot of people have. And realizing, I think when I had to learn, or when I had to realize that addiction and recovery are not, it's not a binary issue. It's not, you know, oh, I'm recovered, click, I'm not recovered, click, I'm recovered. You know, it's a journey.
Yeah.
And it being a chronic medical disease, it is relapsing and remitting. And there are periods of time in an individual's life where substance use is going to be active and they're going to slide, and it could get very, very severe, or it could just be a little bump and they could get back on the track that they want to be on. But I had to learn to accept, understand where patients were, where they were at, but ultimately, maybe more importantly, where it is that they want to go. Because I think I spent a lot of time prior to entering this field with my own conception of what recovery looks like. And it isn't necessarily that for everybody, meaning there are some individuals whose their goal is not abstinence, their goal is low risk and safe consumption. And my job as a physician is to inform them of their risks, find out truly what their ultimate goals are wanting to be, and then try to get them from A to B. It's not for me to decide how they should be living their life. And I think when patients feel accepted and they don't feel like they're being judged, they're very, very honest. When they don't realize, when if they tell you what's going on and they learn, oh, I'm not going to be told what to do, mm-hmm. or I'm not going to be talked down to, or I'm not going to be punished for being honest, when they, and this happens to me in patient interactions all the time. Like a patient will kind of, I can tell they'll throw something out and they'll see what, how I react to it.
Kind of like testing you.
100%. Every single new patient I'm tested and I know it. And they'll just see what, how I react to it. And I think when they see, oh, he's not going to tell me that that's bad, or he's not going to tell me I shouldn't do that. He's just interested in knowing what the role this substance plays in my life. They're honest. And then it's, I mean, dare I say enjoyable, right? Like and then we're just having a conversation and now we're working together.
I feel like those techniques can work in all facets of medicine, not just in substance use, but any time that you talk to a patient about their exercise habits and their diet, which I know I'm not the best at keeping up with the guidelines and recommendations, but I've definitely noticed in my own practice that when I tell a patient about how I have struggled with actually exercising the 150 minutes a week, you know, sharing that I'm understanding that mm-hmm. they're not going to necessarily hit all those target goals and it's okay. I think that certainly has helped develop a good rapport, a trusting relationship, and encourages honesty so that patients or people can get the best and safest care. I wanted to kind of go back to something that you had mentioned in terms of biases and using language that we don't necessarily recognize as something that causes a stigma or has stigma attached to it. Sorry to put you on the spot, but are there any particular words and alternatives that you feel get used pretty often that you would like to recommend maybe we reconsider in our usage?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. Yes, and I say this as somebody, again, who spent a lot of his career using this language and not necessarily thinking anything of it. And I certainly also don't want to imply that somebody is bad because they're using this language, because it's so common in our medical vernacular that we just use these words, but we don't, at least I didn't. I didn't necessarily stop to think about the potential effect that we were having.
Yeah.
The word substance abuse, oh, that's my number one. It is my personal and professional goal to rid this health system of substance abuse within 10 years. I would like it in 2034, I would hope that word is now completely eliminated from the language here at this hospital. And a lot of people, and it's a frustrating, it's hard because those are literally diagnoses.
Yeah.
They have ICD, they have ICD-10 codes attached to them. So, but with that word, it's a very interesting word. So not to go too much off and do a stigma conversation, but it is a topic that I love talking about. So words don't necessarily, there doesn't have to be intent for it to have the impact. And the word abuse in the English language, we only use that word when we're talking about in a situation where usually someone from a position of power or authority is inflicting harm or damage or taking advantage of somebody with less power and authority, right? Like an adult to a child or a superior to a subordinate. Like that's the word that situation is used in.
Yeah.
But when we switch it over to substance use, I would say to you, how can an individual be inflicting intentional damage on an inert substance like cocaine, right? Or alcohol? They can't.
Yeah.
They can't do that. But because we use that word, take that word, and we take all that other connotation that we use and all that negative emotion that we have with that word, and we put it onto that other individual, right? And we can't help that because we're human beings. We're not robots. Words are associated with certain things. And there's actually proof to this. So they did a study where they went to a mental health conference, and they had a hypothetical clinical vignette. And it was about two or three paragraphs, and in one, this was hypothetical, but in one they described the individual as having a substance use disorder, and in the other they described the individual as a substance abuser. Those were the only two things that were different: substance use disorder, substance abuser. And then they asked people how they felt about this theoretical patient, gave them a questionnaire, and they found that if the person was described as a substance abuser, the medical providers were more likely to feel that that person was less likely to benefit from treatment, more likely to benefit from punishment, should be able to control their use, should be more likely to control their use, and should be held more responsible for the consequences.
Wow.
Right? And it was just that single word. So again, it just speaks to the power that our words have. So if I'm working in the emergency department and I call you and I say, hey, Dr. Knight, you know, I got somebody down here and yeah, he's an opioid abuser and he's in withdrawal, but can we get him some treatment? And you're like, absolutely, we'll get him admitted. I guess you would, we should reverse that or something. Yeah. It's like, yeah. OBGYN, you're not seeing a lot of males. But my point being, if I use the word abuser, I have now, what that study tells me is I have now taken those negative connotations about his use disorder and I've now put that in your head. Completely subconsciously, I didn't mean to do it. And I don't want you to feel that way. And you probably wouldn't say that you feel that way. But because of the word choice, I've now put that into your mind. So again, it just speaks to how powerful the words that we use and how kind of inconsequential they may seem, but how they actually have very serious consequences, especially in this patient population.
Honestly, when you say that now, I'm thinking to myself, I hope I haven't referred to patients as substance abusers or used that vernacular when I'm typing up my notes, especially with the ability for patients to reading their own charts.
Mm-hmm,
you know, that certainly, you know, if providers are reading about this patient and thinking that they're not going to be able to benefit from care, I don't want a patient to get that negative connotation on themselves because of a note that I wrote. So thank you for bringing that up. And I am going to try to consciously diminish some of that unconscious bias that I've been typing up in my notes.
And I appreciate you saying that. And I will stop myself all the time when I catch myself using a stigmatizing word, and I will repeat it again. And people point it out to me, and it's not, you know, this isn't the word police, or somebody doesn't come out with that, like, what game is that? The taboo, with the buzzer, when they're right in your
yeah.
face, right? That's not the point. I'm not trying to catch anybody doing anything, but if we don't have these conversations, or if we're not willing to correct ourselves, then we can't make the impact that we have. My favorite conversation, though, even if nothing changes, if anybody who's listening to this now they're always going to hear it.
Yeah.
Because once you hear it, you can't unhear it. So this is my goal. And as I said, in 2033, I want that word to be gone. And I think I can get there. I think I've given myself enough time to get there.
I hope that does happen. And I'm going to remember back at this conversation and look
there
back and go, I can't believe we ever used that.
Ah, there it is. One down.
Yeah.
Several thousand to go.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here for our Reproductive Real Talk podcast discussing substance use disorders and caring for patients that have to deal with all that. So making sure we're getting the appropriate care, making sure that we have support for long-term recovery, and making sure to spread the awareness on not only initial steps towards working toward recovery, but also continuing that care, because it is a chronic process. And we need to be there to support each other and to support all the people around us. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I was so grateful to have the opportunity to come here and speak to that. And again, if anybody needs our services, I hope any way you can reach out, you know, email, in-basket message, I say carrier pigeon, whatever it is, please reach out. And we'll make sure that we get the help that people need.
All right. Well, great. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.